Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with an update of a number of stories that I've dealt with in the past, as well as some new information. When we left off in the last half-hour segment, we were dealing with a blockbuster article from the Electronic Telegraph. That's the web version of the Daily Telegraph of London. And this particular article is, as I said, a blockbuster, one of the most important articles I can recall seeing in recent years. It concerns a conflict between the EU, and between the lines I think we can safely read Germany, which dominates the EU, and the U.S. National Security Agency, which maintains an absolutely crucial strategic electronic listening post at Menwith Hill in Yorkshire. This particular listening post has been known for quite some time, but now the EU is making noise over this, and again, between the lines, I think it is very safe to say that the Germans are upset about the Menwith Hill listening post's capabilities for conducting industrial espionage, something the Germans do all the time. This is a very important article, and it is indicative of a redrawing of the battle lines of World War II. The top struggle in the world now is between the United States and Germany, and to a lesser extent, Great Britain and Germany, sort of Anglo-Saxonia versus Germania. And this attempt by the EU translate Germany to neutralize Menwith Hill is very close to being tantamount to an act of war against the United States. This article, again, is entitled EU Simmers Over Menwith Listening Post. It's by Simon Davies, subtitled Britain Faces a Major Security Battle in Brussels Over the Security Deal That Gives U.S. Spies Access to Sensitive Commercial Information. Skipping down in this article, which we began in our last half-hour segment and overlapping with the material that I dealt with there, whether the commercial espionage activities at Menwith Hill can be defined as, quote, security of general interest, unquote, will depend on a definition yet to emerge from the Commission. For Britain, this will be vitally important. If the NSA's activities are deemed to be of a general security nature, then Britain has fallen foul of its obligations under the treaty. But if those activities are not deemed to be security issues, then the special relationship between the UK and the US may have to be reviewed, since Britain might not be able to continue to offer the NSA the cloak of secrecy it has hitherto enjoyed. Either way, any referral on the matter by one country will put both Britain and America in a delicate diplomatic position. The Commission is also concerned that if the NSA issue escalates further, companies may demand protection. Title II, Article 3C of the treaty requires the creation of, quote, an internal market characterized by the abolition as between member states of obstacles to the free movement of goods, persons, services, and capital, unquote. The existence of a spy base on British soil could potentially act as an obstacle to the free movement of capital by interfering in delicate negotiations and transactions. However, a loophole in the European treaties could ensure that the British arrangement with America survives. In a provision engineered primarily by the UK, any bilateral arrangement between an EU and a non-EU country is exempt from intervention by Brussels or by other member states. The catch-22 is that Brussels cannot even read this special relationship, agreements that form the basis of the NSA's tenure in Britain. The UK-USA agreement, which binds America and Britain to a joint signals intelligence arrangement, is unobtainable. A senior EU security official said, quote, I have never seen such a document, so I would not know how to assess the NSA situation, unquote. Well, again, the Menwith Hill listening post has been known for quite some time. It's something of an open secret. And I would state that, again, this is a terribly important article indicating the redrawing of the lines of power struggle in, on the global stage. It's no longer between the U.S. and the Soviets. It's now between the U.S. and the Germans. This is a terribly significant article. I would also point out that the dividing line between economic and strategic military intelligence is fine to the point of being virtually non-existent, particularly in the nuclear age. It is absolutely essential to monitor the international flow of key goods like ores, key alloys, petroleum, things like rolling stock, strategic materials such as uranium. It's all essential for adequate intelligence gathering. I would also add that it is in America's best, it is in America's national interest to maintain this Menwith Hill listening post. Again, Menwith Hill has been known for quite some time, and it does engage in espionage on economic matters, as Germany does on a routine basis. The definitive book about the National Security Agency is The Puzzle Palace, That was authored by James Bamford, B-A-M-F-O-R-D. It was published in hardcover by Houghton Mifflin in 1982, and there was a softcover edition published by Penguin Books in 1983. And we're going to turn now to James Bamford's The Puzzle Palace, and reading from the softcover Penguin edition from 1983 about the establishment of Menwith Hill. Menwith Hill grew out of an Army security agency station. Of this growth, we read, "Finally, on September 15, 1960, after 5 years and $6.8 million worth of cement and antennas, the 13th U.S. Army Security Agency field station formally opened. Named Menwith Hill Station, the 400-man base, virtually free from urban electromagnetic interference, was ideally suited for eavesdropping." Skipping down. "Soon after the changeover," that is the changeover from Army Security Agency to National Security Agency, "soon after the changeover, the triple-fence listening post started taking on an appearance strikingly similar to Pine Gap's." Pine Gap is a key U.S. electronic intelligence gathering station in Australia. Continuing. "Giant dish-shaped antennas began going up, some accompanied by enormous eggshell-like ray domes set on concrete nests. By 1980, the number of antennas had grown to 8. Beyond the fences were placed signs, in case there was any doubt, warning, Ministry of Defense, Prohibited Place, Official Secrets Act, 1911 to 1939. According to Frank Raven, chief of G Group until 1975, the major reason for the NSA's taking charge was the failure of the Army to allocate sufficient intercept spaces and resources for the much-needed strategic intelligence such as diplomatic and economic targets. Quote, the Army fought like hell to avoid intercepting it, unquote, said Raven. Until NSA moved in, the Army had been using the station primarily for tactical coverage. Also, NSA was upset because no resources had been devoted to intercepting the newer forms of communication like satellite microwave. Principal targets of Menwith Hill, according to Raven, are Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and the Soviet Union east of the Urals." Skipping down again. "Some of Menwith Hill's strategic intercept capabilities were probably inherited from a U.S. Air Force Security Service listening post at Kirk Newton near Edinburgh, which just happened to cease operations the very day before the NSA began operating the Yorkshire station. Some reports indicate that many of the operations formerly performed by Kirk Newton were simply transferred down the road to the new NSA base. One former employee of the Kirk Newton listening post explained the routine," skipping down, quote, "I had to keep a special watch for commercial traffic, details of commodities, what big companies were selling like iron and steel and gas. Changes were frequent. One week, I was asked to scan all traffic between Berlin and London, and another week between Rome and Belgrade. Some weeks, the list of words to watch for contained dozens of names of big companies. Some weeks, I just had to look for commodities. All traffic was sent back to Fort Meade in Washington." So again, Menwith Hill has been known for quite some time. Why all the static is being directed at it, pun intended, by the way, by the EU, translate Germany between the lines, I suspect has to do with the redrawing of the lines of power struggle along the lines that I indicated earlier. And again, I think it's not only in America's best interest to maintain Menwith Hill in its current status, Britain's as well, by the way, but also it's very hypocritical for the Germans to be complaining about industrial espionage. They engage in it wholesale. And in fact, there was a recent article in the Germany Alert newsletter, researched for us by a listener, which talks about new domestic changes in German law to permit the German government to spy on employees in German companies. This along the lines of industrial counter-espionage. Again, this is from Germany Alert. Research credit on this to a listener. From Germany Alert of Friday, July 31st of 1998, we find the following article datelined Bonn and headlined, Bonn forces firms to enable spying on their employees. Chancellor Helmut Kohl's enforcers have ordered German companies and trade unions to finance equipment that will make it easier for the government to eavesdrop on employee phone calls. The move has been called, quote, monstrous, unquote, by a legislator from the pro-government FDP, Detlef Kleinert. Interior Minister Manfred Kanter wants the TKUV, the Telecommunications Monitoring Order, to take effect before the end of this year, according to reports in the Süddeutsche Zeitung. So again, the Germans are committing industrial espionage, as is every other major country on Earth. Again, the significance of the EU, translate Germany, trying to close down Menwith Hill could not be exaggerated. It's one of the most important and one of the most significant stories in a long, long time. And again, as I've covered in numerous programs, RFA 37 and the Seeds of Nuremberg archive shows, a 13 half-hour segment series entitled Reunited Germany, the New Danger. In my interviews with Martin Lee, the author of The Beast Reawakens, and in numerous other programs, I've spoken about the reemergence of German fascism. In fact, because of its anti-communist, anti-labor, and pro-eugenic stance, something which endeared it to many powerful interests in the West, Germany was never effectively denazified. The same basic interests were put in power behind a democratic facade, and now they are coming out from behind that facade. Much of the blame, by the way, for the failure, not only for the rise of Nazism in the first place, but also for the failure of denazification, lies squarely with the United States, as discussed in, among other broadcasts, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, and also the Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow and Connecting the Dots programs done in recent weeks, as I speak, in August of 1998. One of the things that I spoke about in a pair of half-hour segments entitled A Look at Global Fascism, as well as another pair of half-hour segments about Eurofascism, concerned the recent electoral success of the Deutsche Volksunion of Gerhard Frey. Gerhard Frey is a Nazi publisher who puts out a newspaper called the Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung. It was in that paper that disinformation was printed that Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly fired at Edwin Walker. The connection of Frey and the Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung to the Kennedy assassination, discussed in, among other programs, RFA 37, and also the aforementioned recent half-hour segments about A Look at Global Fascism. In that very same pair of half-hour segments about global fascism, I also discussed the connections between Gerhard Frey and Reinhard Gehlen, the Nazi spy chief who jumped first to Western intelligence and the CIA in the aftermath of World War II, and finally Gehlen and his entire Nazi outfit, in effect a front for the Odessa, among other things, the post-World War II SS underground, eventually became the BND, the German Intelligence Service, which they are to this day. Obviously, the original Nazi participants are long gone, but bureaucratic inertia has kept the organization operating along pretty much the same lines. San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, July 23rd of 1998, has the following story, again this by Eric Geiger of the Chronicle Foreign Service. It's datelined Munich and headlined, Germany's far right eyes a rare prize, presence in parliament. Subtitled, Ultranationalists hope to tap anger in eastern states. And it reads in part as follows. While sporadically scoring modest triumphs in local elections, extreme rightist parties have never made it into Germany's federal parliament, due to their constant quarreling with one another and perennial failure to meet a 5% minimum showing needed for representation. But unexpected gains by a far-right party in a state election in eastern Germany this spring have raised fears that this may change when voters across the country go to the polls in September. And skipping down, analysts say the DVU's gain in Saxony-Anhalt provide proof that frustration over persistent high unemployment and disillusionment in the East with unification with Western Germany in 1990 is feeding radicalism, especially among the young. Seasonally adjusted figures released for June indicate that unemployment in the eastern states now stands at 17.2%, compared with 8.9% in the West. Emboldened by its April showing, the Munich-based DVU is currently spearheading efforts to form a far-right alliance for the general election in September. And again, one of the main tickets of the DVU, one of the main candidates of DVU is Franz Schoenhuber, formerly of the Republikaner Party, who's a former Waffen-SS sergeant. And by the way, when I talk about the reemergence of German fascism from behind its democratic facade, I don't want to be misinterpreted as saying that most, all, or even most Germans are Nazis or fascists. That's not true. Wasn't true in the Hitler period either. The first victims of Nazism were the German people themselves. They were the first to feel the Gestapo's lash. And again, much of the blame for not only the establishment of Nazism, but its perpetuation into the post-World War II period belongs with that transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I spoke about in the program The Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow, the programs called Connecting the Dots, and in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, as well as the first two RFA shows. More about Gerhard Frey and the DVU. Gerhard Frey and his organization are now forming an operational link with the Front National of France, the French fascist group growing in power and that is headed up by Jean-Marie Le Pen. I've spoken about Le Pen in the past, in particular in a pair of recent half-hour segments entitled Fascism à la Mode. I compared Le Pen and the fascist parties of Europe and their rhetoric and strategies with the Republican Party of the United States, a much larger and supposedly respectable party, but in fact every bit as fascist as Fry's DVU and the Front National, and an organization that has a major wing, the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council, that is literally an outgrowth of the Third Reich. And again, fascism is not by no means limited to Germany. This is from the New York Times of Tuesday, June 16th of 1998. The following is a Reuters story datelined Bonn, June 15th, headlined, Rightist Alliance in Germany and France. The anti-immigrant German People's Union and France's right-wing National Front said today they would support each other's campaigns for elections to the European Parliament in 1999. The German People's Union leader, Gerhard Fry, whose party shocked Germany with a strong showing in a state election in April, and the National Front leader, Jean-Marie Le Pen, said the two parties would also look to form a grouping in the parliament after the vote. Both parties will expand and strengthen their links, unquote, they said in a joint statement released by the German party, which is based in Munich. Quote, both party chairmen are united on the basic common points of their political programs, unquote. The statement said the two parties backed further limits on immigration and wanted, quote, the interests of citizens in both countries to be given priority over those of foreigners, unquote. Again, it's very much like the line being espoused now by the Republican Party. And recall, as discussed in the program, a look at global fascism. The Republican Party sent Representative Bob Young. Now, it was on an unofficial basis, but Bob Young, nonetheless, a seated member of the Republican House of Representatives, was representing the Republican Party at the recent official Congress of the Italian Fascist Party, the Alleanza Nazionale, in Verona, in Italy. That, again, from a look at global fascism. Turning back to Fry's DVU and the nature of that particular party, recall that New York Times article spoke about Fry's DVU hooking up with the main French fascist party, the Front National. More about the DVU and Gerhard Fry. This comes from the Europeans issue of May 4th through 10th of 1998. This article was researched for us by Ted Rubenstein, who's been getting articles for us for quite some time. This is an article by Tony Patterson in Magdeburg. It's headlined, The Fat Man Who Would Be Führer. The article reads in part as follows, skipping down, of the DVU. Fry's DVU has barely 15,000 members, mostly SS or Wehrmacht veterans, who are gradually being replaced by sections of Germany's neo-Nazi skinhead youth. And skipping down again. Born into a well-heeled family in the West German town of Cham, C-H-A-M, in 1933, the year Hitler came to power, Fry was taught to revere the reactionary Freikorps, a paramilitary grouping of First World War veterans that preceded the Nazis and which his father supported. By the way, the Freikorps committed a series of assassinations in the 1920s, which paved the way for Hitler's rise to power, not unlike the way the American political assassinations of the 60s and early 70s helped to pave the way for the rise of American fascism in the 80s and 90s. Note here that Fry's DVU was originally composed largely of former SS or Wehrmacht veterans, and note that Fry was taught to revere the Freikorps. By the way, the activities of the Freikorps are discussed in RFA 10, that again available from Spitfire. Of the genesis of Gerhard Fry's Deutsche Nationalzeitung und Soldatenzeitung, which he publishes to this day, and again in which the disinformation that Lee Harvey Oswald fired at Edwin Walker was first printed several days before Marina Oswald supposedly disclosed that to the light of day for the first time, we read in the Searchlight magazine of June 1998 as follows. By the way, the Searchlight is a British anti-fascist publication, not to be confused with the American Spotlight, its ideological opposite number. Very similar names. However, the Searchlight is British, the Spotlight is American, and the Searchlight is anti-fascist, and the Spotlight is its opposite ideological number. Turning to the Searchlight of June of 1998, in an article about Gerhard Fry entitled Half a Century of Nazi Empire Building, we read, skipping down, Fry's involvement in the fascist movement started in the 1950s when he was a freelance contributor to the monthly paper Deutsche Soldatenzeitung. This paper had been founded in 1951 by the former Waffen-SS General Felix Steiner and a host of other former SS men and Nazi Party members, and its target readership consisted overwhelmingly of Wehrmacht and SS veterans. Because the paper was seen as a bulwark against communism, it was able for several years to get funding from the newly founded German Federal Republic State Press Office and the U.S. Occupation Administration. Again, under the common bond of anti-communism, obviously the German federal government funded this publication, founded by a key Waffen SS general. And as we looked at in the past with several former SS men and former Goebbels propaganda ministry veterans on its editorial board, and the U.S. Occupation Administration of Germany also helped to finance this publication of Gerhard Fry's. Again, as I've said, a lot of the blame, not only for the creation of Nazism and fascism in the first place, but also for its resurrection after World War II, lies with the Western powers, the U.S. in particular. They revived the Nazis largely as an anti-communist tool. That liaison between Western intelligence and Nazi war criminals, primarily the operatives of the Odessa working within the Galen organization, is now apparently the focus of a congressional inquiry. The following article appeared in the San Jose Mercury News of Sunday, August 2nd of 1998. This is an article by Ronald Powers of the Associated Press. Its headline, Dateline Washington headlined, Prying Open Files of Cold War, subtitled Anti-Communism. Congress wants secret documents on dealings between U.S. intelligence and Nazi war criminals finally to be declassified. This article reads in part as follows, and by the way, discussion of the Reinhard Galen Nazi spy outfit is in numerous programs, both half-hour segments and archive shows, the first three RFA shows, and RFA 36 and RFA 37 in particular go into the Galen org. There are others as well. Contact Spitfire for more information. Reading from this article, again, an AP story by Ronald Powers, 8298. Under pressure from Congress, the Justice Department, and other agencies may be forced to declassify tens of thousands of top-secret documents describing the U.S. intelligence community's dealings with Nazi war criminals during the Cold War. Legislation to open most of these files already has passed the Senate and could come up for a vote in the House as early as this week. Some historians suspect opening the files could cause, quote, tremendous embarrassments, unquote, for the United States. And, quote, this potentially is the biggest series of revelations since the Nuremberg war crimes trials, unquote, said historian Robert Herzstein, speaking by telephone from his office at the University of South Carolina. There will be cases that the authorities would prefer not to come out, he said, again quoting, this was all done in the name of anti-communism in the early Cold War, unquote. And again, that's discussed in numerous programs available from Spitfire. Last couple of years has been a lot of focus on the Nazi flight capital program, in particular gold that was secreted by the Nazis abroad, largely through Swiss banks and neutral countries. As I mentioned at the beginning of a couple of half-hour segments about the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, the fuss about this gold, and I'm not denigrating the suffering of Holocaust victims, but this story also has been known for a long, long time. And in fact, serious students of World War II and its aftermath know that underlying the story of the Nazi flight capital, again, is the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, literally the economic component of an underground Reich, and an institution that I believe will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet. And not only the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, but also the reinstitution of Nazi elements in the Federal Republic at the end of World War II by the United States is to be seen between the lines, and really not even between the lines, but is the foundation for a very important story which appeared in the New York Times of Friday, July 24th of 1998. This is a story by Alan Cowell, datelined Berlin, July 23rd, and headlined, Germans admit files have disappeared on gold that Nazis stole from Jews. It reads in part as follows. In a twist to the Nazi gold saga, German officials acknowledged today that 26 crucial secret files containing records of gold stolen from Jews in concentration camps had mysteriously disappeared from German archives long after World War II. The discovery raised several questions about the fate of the documents, including the possibility that they had been deliberately destroyed to cover the tracks of former Nazi banking officials entrusted by the Allies with high offices in post-war Germany. The files were named, speaking of these files that are missing, the files were named for Bruno Melmer, a notorious SS officer whose job from 1942 to 45 was to amass personal gold and jewelry stolen from Jews in Auschwitz and other death camps, part of a widespread effort to accumulate looted gold to finance Hitler's war effort. Skipping down. The German report chronicled a series of lapses by German and American officials in safeguarding the documents. Quote, To outside observers, it will seem incomprehensible that documents so closely linked to the crimes of Nazism could be distributed so carelessly and finally lost, unquote, the report said, according to a German official who insisted on anonymity. The files were located in 1945 by American troops in eastern Germany. The report said the documents were shipped to the United States, where some were microfilmed. But sections, apparently including the 26 Melmer files, were not. The documents included the Melmer files and other account books that tallied gold receipts by the Precious Metals Department of the Reichsbank, the German Central Bank. Inexplicably, the documents were handed back to the German authorities in 1948 and left in care of the Bank Deutscher Länder, the forerunner of the present German Central Bank, the Bundesbank. A top official of that institution, the report said, was Albert Toms, who headed the Reichsbank department that processed looted gold and whom the Allies rehabilitated after the war. After Mr. Toms' death in 1977, his estate was found to include confidential documents that had been missing from bank archives. So again, the reinstitution of Nazi elements in Germany after the war figures in the background of that story, as does the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. And I wonder whether perhaps the recent attention on Nazi gold fleeing abroad through Switzerland and neutral countries, again, at the root of which is the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, has had something to do with yet another alleged proof of Martin Bormann's death in World War II. Reading now from the New York Times of May 4th of 1998, we read in an article datelined Frankfurt, May 3rd, Martin Bormann's remains said to be verified. This article reads in part, genetic tests confirm that remains found in Berlin in 1972 are of Hitler's private secretary Martin Bormann, who helped organize the Holocaust and was rumored to have escaped Germany after World War II, according to news reports today. Skipping down, an 83-year-old relative of Bormann supplied the samples for the DNA comparison, according to Der Spiegel. Florian Besold, a lawyer for the Bormann family, said last month that they wanted the testing partly because of a 1996 book by a British author who said Bormann was smuggled out of Berlin to England in 1945. Quote, it has to do with finally ending these crazy international rumors, unquote, Mr. Besold said at the time. Again, I wonder whether this disinformation, and disinformation it is, was being surfaced again because of the recent attention on the Nazi gold going through Switzerland, which at the core of which is the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Turning now to the definitive text about the Bormann Organization, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, who worked with, covered the war in Europe for CBS News along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, we read the following concerning the FBI's discovery of an Argentine intelligence file. Reading now from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, when the file, now in my possession, was received at FBI headquarters, it revealed that the Reichsleiter had indeed been tracked for years. One report covered his whereabouts from 1948 to 1961 in Argentina, Paraguay, Brazil, and Chile. The file revealed that he had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany in Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and on August 4th, 5th, and 14th, 1967, had written checks on demand accounts at First National City Bank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. That again from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by Paul Manning, Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981. That's all we have time for. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.